The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Charlene Nemeth. Charlene is professor of psychology at the University of California, Berkeley. In 2005 to 2009, she was visiting professor of organizational behavior at London Business School. Her work has been featured in Wired, The New Yorker, Fast Company, and various other media outlets. She advises numerous important institutions on effective decision-making, including the Supreme Court of the United States. She has a new book called In Defense of Troublemakers, The Power of Dissent in Life and Business. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
If I'm not mistaken, and I did a little bit of research on this, the publishers of the UK version of your new book titled it No. That's a bit ironic because I'm having you on the Yes And podcast, but I actually want to start there because there's a lot of misconception around our idea of Yes And, which connects to ideas you discuss in the book. So for us, Yes And is about making space for like the wild idea, for the inconceivable suggestion, for the outlier concept. And we have a creative system that allows for those ideas to be shared and tested. But it's not about consensus. I would liken it to sort of pro-social dissent. And I think I just made up that term. I'm not sure. And your no is still ultimately about getting to like a yes or a truth, right?
That's right. I mean, you know, absolutely. I mean, I actually winced at the title of Troublemakers at first, even mm-hmm. though it's very catchy, because the whole point of the book is really not one of argument for argument's sake or even dissent for dissent's sake. It really has to do with authenticity. I mean, it really has to do with when you have a differing opinion from, say, a majority or from the consensus. Most people are afraid, basically. They don't speak up. Companies have that problem all the time. And the thing that, a lot of people realize is that sometimes you want it for the truth it may have, but what our research really emphasizes is that even if it's wrong, is that the fact that the majority or the consensus is challenged actually stimulates thinking that by and large improves decision-making and creative problem-solving. It basically just gets you to think in broader, more divergent ways. And that's a benefit regardless of whether or not they hold a truth or not.
Totally. And okay, so before we dig into dissent, okay. And that's really going to be the bulk of this, you do have to understand what the meaning of the majority perspective is. And you write, quote, on balance, we make poorer decisions and think less creatively when we adopt the majority perspective. I bet that's going to be surprising for some people to hear.
Yeah, you know, forgive me. It's sort of when you think about something for a long time, my mind starts going in about eight directions.
Okay.
I think there, here's where the real problem is that the majorities have a lot of power, whether they're right or wrong, and so we follow them. And sometimes they provide information, but a lot of times they are wrong. But the real issue is we follow them regardless. We agree with them regardless of whether they're right or wrong. And we mainly do it for two reasons. The simple one is, one, we assume that truth lies in numbers, so we think that the fault must lie in us,
right,
that they can't all be right. I can't be right and they're all wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But the second reason is this thing of wanting to belong and fearing repercussions, fearing ridicule. And so what happens is that it takes extra courage to speak up and challenge when you believe something different, even though it benefits the group. But so most people opt for silence, essentially, is that they basically decide that it's not going to make any difference, and all that's going to happen is I'm going to get ridiculed. And so that's why you have companies have a lot of trouble with people who see a problem and they don't speak up about it. I use in the book the example of the plane goes down because people don't speak up loudly about the fact they're running out of fuel. You know, you get a lot of different examples of, medical teams where somebody notices something wrong with the machine. If they don't speak up, that could be a death. So they're not trivial issues by a long shot, you know.
Right. And the thing that we're fighting here, and we've talked about this in the podcast before, is the worst thing that can happen in an organization is organizational silence. That is probably, you're in a very dark place when no one's speaking up because it means that they're probably not collaborating, they're probably not listening to each other, and they're not sharing the truth. And you actually go so far as to say, quote, the majority has the ability to bend reality. What do you mean when you say that?
Well, our studies ever since the 1950s show that people will agree with an erroneous majority judgment, even when it's on physical facts.
Hmm.
So, you know, those early studies, by Solomon Ash, were on a simple length of lines. Namely, if you're making the judgments alone, you make no mistakes. These aren't kind of ambiguous or tough problems. Right? I mean, it's just flat in front of your face. But what you find is that if you put as few as three people, all of whom agree on something that's wrong, is that over 35% of the individuals will follow that judgment.
Wow.
They start to see a reality in a way that they would not if they were making the judgment alone. And these are not, judgments or things where there's ambiguity and there's five different ways of looking at it. This is a flat out right physical judgment in front of you. So, blue becomes green. And, I know right away what comes to mind is this notion of what's fake and what's true.
I was just going to ask about that. Yeah, because this is part of our national conversation right now. We are
absolutely.
It's propaganda, right? It's propaganda. I see it on my social media feeds where whether it's my friends on the left or friends on the right pushing out, they don't even know who the source is. They're just pushing out this information, which may or may not be true. And often it really just isn't.
No, that's right. And the trouble is it's hard to decipher what is or what isn't. I think, I'll tell you what scares me the most, in all honesty, is that people not only follow error, when it's held by the many rather than the few, but that they actually do so without reflection. Mm. You see, it's one thing to make an analysis, for example, that all these people actually have some information and their agreement has informational value. And that can be true under certain circumstances. It isn't across the board true, where people come away with that notion sometimes. The real problem is we assume it's true just because it's held by the many.
Right.
And so what happens is that if you start agreeing and believing things with losing sight of what your own eyes tell you, what you know yourself, what you would say if you hadn't heard the three people, that then becomes a problem because the real issue for me has always been the quality of the thought and the quality of the decision. So it's not that you follow the majority. That's not the problem. There might be occasions when that's smart.
Yeah.
The problem is you do so without reflection and analysis. You do so without actually even knowing what you know anymore. That's the part that's scary, but it also shows enormous power that we have over one another, the enormous power of opinions. And particularly, which is obviously what I focus on in the book, the big distinction is whether it's held by the many or the few, whether it's consensus or dissent.
Getting into dissent, and this is very interesting, obviously, from where I work and the sort of like political, socio-political history of Second City and knowing improvisation and part of what improvisation does when you're doing it is it promotes divergent thinking because you have no idea what the person across from you is going to say. You can't prepare to respond to it. You have to listen to the last word and just go. So it's very much sort of system one, system two, going back and forth in your brain. And you write that dissent makes us more complex thinkers. So how does it do that?
The real weeds of the how we probably don't fully understand. We know that it happens and have some hints.
Hmm.
But I think a big chunk of it, because, you know, I've studied kind of creativity in a slightly different context than an improv, yeah. but I'm fascinated by improv. I've often thought that I wanted to collaborate in some research with improv, because mm-hmm. I think it's a remarkably good technique. But I think that in the context of decision-making groups, there is something about challenge. And so, you know, you and make a long story short, I don't think people really reassess their opinions all that easily, mm-hmm. even though some psychologists may suggest otherwise. And we can get into this if you want, but I don't think it happens either by role playing. And so that's why we did studies on that. We can go into that.
Yeah.
But I think the big thing is that when you hold an opinion, particularly when it's bolstered by everybody else and you're part of the majority, you really don't. I mean, there is an arrogance about that, and there is an assumption that any dissenter has got to be, you know, an idiot or has bad intentions or something of that sort. And so it's easy to kind of ignore them. And what the bottom line of the research is on how minority opinions prevail is that they have to be consistent and they have to be authentic. And when that is held by a human being that honestly disagrees with you and is willing to persist and is willing to even incur risks associated with it, that is kind of a wake-up call. And what people do, I think, is that they unfreeze. They go back to almost like how you first form an opinion, where you start looking at multiple sources of information, different ways of looking at the issue. And we have studies on every one of these things I'm saying, you know, kind of I'm tripping them off in three words, but there are substantial data-driven studies on each of this. That's what authentic dissent does. Is that they really do search on all sides of the issue. They do use multiple strategies in problem solving. There is even, we did some studies on, even there's more originality in thought. And so what you find is that the mind really opens when challenged by dissent. You may not like it, you may not like them, but what you actually do is, in fact, the quintessential divergent thinking, which leads to better decision-making and better problem-solving.
So you touched on this idea that for dissent to be effective, to actually have effect change, that it needs to be consistent. When I read that, I actually read that section out loud to my wife at the time, because I'm like, oh, this explains so much what's going on again in our country right now with, you know, people really feeling like, no, I've got to take this back, or both sides, you know, liberal, conservative, whatever, you know, I got to take it back, and giving no quarter, giving no room for all, just sort of staying consistent with the message no matter what comes up. And we sort of lost any subtlety and any nuance. It's like you just can't be nuanced, which feels like, you know, the death of an intellectual discussion or any sort of important way to communicate. Is that tied into what's going on right now?
I'm sorry. You mean the fact that they're not communicating?
The consistency, the idea that that people are just putting their stake and their flag in, and no matter, even if they're, you know, faced with some really good ideas on the other side, they just won't adopt them because they think that will, you know, give up space and they'll lose.
Right, right. I think it's a slightly different slant.
Yeah, tell me.
In the sense that when a dissenter wants to persuade, which is different than a setting, say, an improv or in a group where you're bouncing off ideas of one another. But if you're talking about, say, a discussion, you're trying to come up with the best decision. If the dissenter says things kind of like once and lets it go, or says once and then backs off as soon as he gets pressure, there'll be no impact. Yep. There's a whole ton of studies. And what you really find is that the necessary, if not sufficient, condition for the minority viewpoint to prevail or to actually change minds and hearts is that they need some consistency over time. And I think part of the reason for that is that you have to feel that they have a position that they really believe.
Mm-hmm.
And so all the things, and so they can't compromise quickly, which we did some studies on. If they do that, then they lose all credibility in terms of really having a position. I mean, from that perspective, you also realize the power of a martyr. Mm-hmm. Is that you may think they're crazy and that the idea isn't worth dying for, but the fact that they're willing to die for it, the fact that they're willing to persist over time and anguish and everything else, is that there's something very compelling about that. And even if you don't buy their position, it gets you to think. And that's mm-hmm. what the heart of my research is getting you to think, and to think widely and with curiosity and with openness. Essentially a search for the correct answer, rather than, you know, kind of going into your tribe or whatever the current language is, or as I think you were kind of pointing out with regard to a kind of a mindset of no, mm-hmm. is that people sometimes listen to an argument and all they're doing is counter-arguing in their own head and then waiting for a minute to be able to say it, namely tell you the error of your ways. That's not the spirit of, we're not talking about a mindset of no. We're talking about a willingness to say no, or a willingness to say, I believe something differently.
Yeah, that's interesting. I want to touch on one thing you brought up earlier, because you talked about the fact that they can't compromise too early, but they can. Sometimes this can be effective, you say, if they compromise late.
Well, that's one study that we did back when, and it was basically we were comparing the negotiation literature with this literature that we had pretty much developed on the power of dissent. And the funny thing about dissent is a lot of times, even if you persuade somebody, it's often not at a public level. They'll still tell you you're crazy and they hate you, mm-hmm. but their minds have changed. And you often have to ask them a little later, or you've got to couch the way you ask them or whatever, but it's a very powerful amount of persuasion, but you just don't get credit for it. Okay, so we were comparing this with this notion, and also, by the way, since compromise doesn't work, there are studies that basically show that if there's any inconsistency, even if you agree with them part of the time, whatever the form is, you have no impact at all if you have a minority position. I mean, consistency is essential. I'm sorry, that was a bit of a distraction. Hold on a sec.
Okay.
You asked about the late compromise. So basically, all we did in that study is we were kind of pitting consistency over time with compromise. Hmm. And we essentially had two layers of compromise. One kind of early, it was like a series of 10 rounds on a verdict jury deliberation. And the bottom line of it is that if they compromise early, so you see that the guy's taking a position, now all of a sudden he's changing his mind, or he's coming towards you now already. What will happen is you'll mimic that for the moment, and you'll trade. So from a negotiation point of view, you can get people to move a bit, but you get no change in attitudes whatsoever. The thing that's interesting is if he's consistent over time, even though you dislike him and you won't show any persuasion in public, there's a lot of persuasion at a private level mm-hmm. in the way you view related issues. So that's clearly there. Where they had it kind of both ways is that if they compromised at the very end, they had it both ways. They got a reciprocal public accommodation. But importantly, they also actually change minds, so that when you look at related cases or things later, I'm sorry, I'm getting a little bit in the weeds on this, but they also have impact. And I think the reason there is that their compromise at the last minute was not viewed as inconsistency or mm-hmm. not being sure what they believed. It was viewed as a last-minute ditch effort in order to come to an agreement. In a jury setting. Mm-hmm. Back to juries just for a second, as a side point, is that a lot of times juries will make a decision that nobody believes,
right.
which is sort of idiotic when you think about it, but it's because they negotiate it. So it's like the guy's either guilty of first-degree murder or he's not guilty, depending on whether, say, you believe an eyewitness. Mm-hmm. And yet they may compromise and agree on some verdict of, like, manslaughter. Mm-hmm. Nobody believes it's manslaughter. But it just is a way of kind of showing that sometimes compromise, you know, everybody talks about, you know, we should compromise. But a lot of times that leads to, like, the worst possible decision from a correctness point of view.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the example you use, which I think is the way that people can really get this, is the 12 Angry Men, the film.
Yes.
That's the perfect example of, you know, because at the end, right, he agrees to vote the other way if, you know, everyone else feels the same way. And I think it's a hidden vote or something.
Well, that was a very smart procedural move on his part,
mm-hmm.
because basically he had argued it long enough that he knew that, you know, people weren't budging. He was going to have a heck of a problem, and he had just about shot his wad, you know, to use the proper term. I think at that point, though, what the principle there is that if he can get an ally, and see, that's the other role of dissent, actually, that we didn't kind of totally cover. But another power of dissent, apart from the fact that it stimulates this divergent thinking, is that it breaks the power of the consensus. It breaks the power of mindless following. So there's a lot of studies that if you get somebody who disagrees with the majority, even if they're wrong and even if they're more wrong than the majority, and it was even one study, like even if the guy can't see, you know, I mean, literally, the fact that there is dissent liberates the rest of us. And so we start to see what we see, we know what we know. Knowing that, you see, is that Henry Fonda in 12 Angry Men was kind of in a position, he needed an ally, but how's he going to get one? Mm-hmm. He knew that once he got an ally, it's going to really free up the rest of that majority, and that's what the film's about. But how did he get the first ally? He was pounding away and getting no place, and then it was a procedural decision, and he offered, he said, look, let's have another vote, and I won't vote. But if all the rest of you vote on guilty, I won't stay in the way. Then we'll render that as the verdict. Okay. Now, it was too high-minded for anybody to say no to. But what he was counting on, because his timing was right, is that there was one guy he could tell was wavering. He didn't have the guts to speak up, but he could tell the guy was rethinking it. But now it was going to be on him whether or not this verdict was going to stay, you know, not guilty could stay alive as a discussion. So they had the vote, and of course it's a dramatic portrayal, but yes, there's one not guilty vote. And, of course, it all hell breaks loose, you know, at that within the group. But then you can see that now everything is going to start to open. A lot of people who had doubts now start to talk about them. They start reassessing the evidence of, the of like, eyewitness testimony. I mean, I can give the details, but it doesn't matter. It's basically they start really doing better decision-making. They really are looking at the pros as well as the cons of a position. They're really analyzing in a critical way each piece of evidence. And so they essentially then all come to the decision that not guilty was really the proper verdict. But that procedural move was very smart, but from a social psychological point of view, it's just mainly that it was a vehicle with which one guy got put in a position to stand up or to bear a responsibility that it fell on him. He did stand up, and we know the power of that dissent for breaking the consensus, and so the rest now are fragmented and moving and much more malleable. So it's a wonderful portrayal. I mean, it's a great, it's a, you know.
Yeah. So this is what this makes me think of, and this was the puzzle as I was reading the book and seeing parallels in my work. So there's when you become an improviser, and at Second City in particular, there's this great phrase that Rick Thomas, who's a former actor and teacher, has, which is he says you need to fall into the crack in the game. And what he's getting at is when a mistake happens on stage, you seize that as an opportunity and you go with it, because that's where, like, kind of really interesting stuff happens. And I kind of feel like with the point, what it seems to be saying is that the point of dissent presents an opportunity for you to change your thinking, find what might be true. And and I guess what you're saying too is it doesn't matter if that dissenter is right, but by challenging you, you're getting out of, like, this groupthink or this stuff that we call brainstorming, which I think your research shows doesn't work mostly.
Yeah, actually, there's several points in it. I mean, that's a very interesting perspective. Brainstorming can work. I think one of the, I guess in the book where I use it, though, which is a device for generating creative ideas, as you well know. But all what we really did is that most of the time, and actually gets back to your yes approach, to approach things positively. And you had me really thinking about this, too, because there's clearly a lot in there about a positive approach. And one of the rules of brainstorming, one of the traditional rules ever since the 1950s of Osborne, is to build on the ideas of others. And so that approach is really very important. And that has a very positive approach. I think to some extent, this is going to sound funny maybe, and I haven't thought this through completely, but dissent actually can have that quality too.
Yeah.
I don't want dissent to be one where you're arguing. That's never been the image. It's been one where what you hope is that someone is sort of stimulated and tintillated by it. It's like those hot research groups or those you know, those teams that kind of really work, that have a magic to them,
yep,
is that the fact that they're challenging you or they think something different isn't something that you're afraid of. It's actually something that excites you.
Yep.
Because you find yourself thinking in a more energetic way. You're actually exploring. And that's actually very exciting. And we often tend to always view this as just negative arguing, because that's what we see a lot of, like, you know, as you mentioned, like on the news, because they are not in dialogue. They're making their own points side by side.
Yeah, it's a monologue.
And so, you know, as you, I know you know this phrase, but actually one of my best friends in the field is Carl Weick, mm-hmm, and everybody quotes him. They sometimes forget to cite him for it. But it's, you know, argue as though you're right, which is the point of dissenting viewpoints, actually persuading.
Yep.
But the second part's important, which is listen as if you're wrong.
I've used that phrase in like every keynote I deliver. It's usually my closing line, and I do give him credit.
Yeah, and I tried to hire him many years ago. I mean, he's one of my absolute all-time favorite people
so
in the world.
Yep.
But very brilliant. But there's so much truth in that, and it keeps coming back in many ways.
Yeah.
But I think that kind of listening as if you're wrong is an extremely important mindset.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if people had that attitude toward dissent, because, I mean, you know, you may like using Carl's closing line. I tend to use Senator Fulbright's closing line, or sometimes when I'm in a more humorous mood, I'm a big fan of Mark Twain's.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but with Fulbright, it's that we should learn to welcome and not fear the voices of dissent.
Right.
Because you think that the immediate reaction is one to suppress it, shut it down, and you're armed with this notion of it's one guy, what does he know? And secondly, you're just full of your own power. And so what happens is that you lose not only the possible truth that he has, but you lose, more importantly, I think, the stimulation that interacting and listening to that can do. You know, people treat sometimes dissent like it's a virus that's going to contaminate you, where in fact it's that if you're not afraid of it, and I think that gets into your world more, and I'd be curious how you thought about it,
mm-hmm,
but where you essentially rather than fear it, is that you kind of embrace it. You're not going to die from it. You're going to survive just fine, but the thing is you'll be stronger. And I get a flavor of that coming in improv.
Yeah.
And tell me about that.
Well, it's a couple things going on, right? One, you're developing a kind of a callus for failure, and we're promoting resiliency. So you're encouraged. You're going to fall flat on your face so many times that you stop even worrying about that, and you learn to sort of we have a phrase: play the scene you're in, not the scene you want to be in. So you have to take whatever information is happening, whatever stimulus is happening in the room, and you use it. And you can't ignore it. Can't pretend it's not there. This is why a lot of improv training is about, like, don't reference someone who's not on the stage. Don't, answer a call that doesn't come. You know, be in the moment with the person you're with. And if it's thorny and not working, then you should be working with the fact that it's thorny and not working. And that is, because I think we're reflexively trying to make it right. You know, we're reflexively trying to find the ABC pattern. But that doesn't always exist. And in fact, mostly it isn't. And what you made me think of is the way that Danny Kahneman talks about sort of seeing the world as a problem, you know, starting from there. But he doesn't do that with this sort of negativity. Like, you know, Danny and Amos laughed all the time. So they sort of took joy in the fact that things were wrong and they had their mistakes. So I think that's kind of what we're both talking about, which is dissent shouldn't be seen as a negative, because even when it is wrong, it's at least, you know, pushing us closer to finding a potential truth.
Yes, I think that's right. You remind me, too. I mean, Danny I've known for many years, by the way. He was at his next door office to me here at Berkeley for some time. And he also followed me to British Columbia, actually, before that, because he came.
Right.
He moved there first. It was my position, actually, because I moved right at that moment to Berkeley. And then, I've known him for a while. But what you make me also think of in kind of commenting on the laughter about the fact that the things we study, we're still subject to,
yeah,
namely the fact that biases out there doesn't remove him or anybody else from the same kind of stupidities, if you will, the same short-circuiting, the same kind of ego-driven ways of looking at the world. I mean, we're not free from it. But you'd think at one level, though, is it, it should humanize us, because yeah. when it's all said and done, we're all basic human beings with just a ton of flaws. And I really think that, this, for me at least, survival is laughing at
yeah.
that and laughing at ourselves. Because
yeah.
we don't have that. I mean, it could get really depressing, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, so some of the things that you say, as you were talking about, like living in the moment and dealing with things as they come and trying not to be afraid of them but to embrace them, it seems to be a rule for life.
Yeah.
You know, apart from creativity or improv or humor. And you know, I think that's very special. I really mm-hmm. do.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say, we just created a program about improvisation for caregivers that we did in partnership with a group called Caring Cross Generations, and we're doing at the Cleveland Clinic in Las Vegas. And it's a six-week program working with these caregivers, and a lot of what we are teaching with them is to, you know, they work with a lot of people who have dementia and Alzheimer's, and we're saying instead of blocking them, and we've worked with experts in this field, exist in their reality for a while. You know, and what happens when you play in their reality for all, because their reality is their reality. And what the caregivers said when they came back was like, oh my God, this was a completely different experience, communicative mm-hmm. experience. They really connected in a way that they hadn't been connected, and all they had to do was stop blocking. And, you know, we teach not to block on the stage, but, you know, to your point, what if we stopped blocking in life? Because you see this play out, I'm sure, at work. Most people do, but certainly in family issues or dating or relationships, you know, it's all just human being stuff, right?
Yeah. You're making me smile now only because I'm, you know, sort of reflecting a bit on even family interactions recently, but it kind of pulling into the more professional realm, though, is that even companies have learned a lot by just walking in the shoes of their consumer or their customer,
mm-hmm.
because it's amazing how we just don't look at it from their perspective. And if we do, many times we learn things, not only about them, but about ourselves.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing I'm kind of struck by that you said, for what it's worth, is I spent 3 years with about 12 hours of interview with each of 5 Nobel laureates in physics and chemistry,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, like the inventor of the laser, transuranium elements and stuff. And, you know, a lot of my colleagues thought, well, those guys are so arrogant, you know, they, you know, couldn't be bothered, you know, whatever, which I didn't find. You know, as I said, I spent 11 to 12 hours with each of them, but they'd never done it in their lives. But, you know, the thing I struck by is how humble they were.
Wow.
Is that, you know, if you invent the laser, listen, he deserves to be arrogant if he wanted to be, as far as I'm concerned,
yeah.
but he wasn't. There was a sense in which, in the context of history and in the context of astrophysics, which he was working on, you know, the cosmos, is that, you know, what is this one little person? You know, you can't get too full of yourself.
Yeah.
Not if you're bright and you have that perspective. And so sometimes when you watch how scared the people are who don't have that level of self-acceptance, the spats they get into, the contrivances, the mean-spirited quality of it, the gossip, you know, whatever. It's sort of painful, and I just gave a talk recently, actually. It was kind of on the journey of my interests. But I found myself talking about that sometimes things come that just matter to you personally.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these issues of authenticity, you know, of humility, of searching for the truth. But I was mainly struck, you know, the reason I went into social psychology was, I was a math undergraduate degree, by the way, but it was one course in social psychology when I was a junior, and the lecture was on brainwashing techniques in the Korean War. And I came away thinking how important we are for each other, how much we can be, you know, for good or for evil, you know, for good or for bad. And one can just look throughout history of the heroes and the, you know, and the kind of the evil perpetrators or whatever. But the impact that we have on people and the fact of, you know, we're social animals of belonging and acceptance, but a notion of authenticity and knowing what we know and feeling free to express it. All those notions of trust and respect and words we throw around are powerfully important. Because in that lecture, I remember being struck by the fact that some of those men, when the bonds between them broke down. And you could do that by getting one to snitch on the other, but there's no negative repercussions for the guy you snitched on, but you get some better food. What happens over time is you break down the bonds.
Yeah.
And there were men laying in their beds and dying because they didn't have that kind of social support. And I remember being struck by the fact that I may like mathematics, but it kind of didn't matter to me in the same way that at least trying to understand how, you know, how we can be forces, hopefully, for, you know, for good or for finding some kind of a truth or at least being reflective. But it looks like it's a never-ending battle.
So I was going to say that. So how interesting that that's your choice to get in because you're looking at isolation and connectedness. And then, you know, the internet happens, social media happens, all these things that do on some level connect us in a hyper sort of way, but also do the opposite. You know, allow us to sort of be nameless and voiceless. And, you know, I say this a lot to guests because my daughter has a friend who'll only fight via text. And I'm like, this is how trolls get made. This is the opposite of being connected. And because we're not that they don't have the gift of seeing how they hurt someone when they say that terrible thing that they never want to feel that way again. So it's such an interesting crossroads with now this whole technology part that really didn't exist for us. I think for both of us when we were, you know, early in our careers, but now does.
Mm-hmm. No, you're right. And I think also lost is exactly what you do so well, really, and that's the art of conversation.
Yeah. Okay, so we already went long, which I knew was going to happen because this is really interesting stuff. But I do want to ask you for a yes and story from your own life. You know, anyone listening to the podcast, we end the conversation always with a yes and story. And so I'm wondering if you have one for us.
Okay, so it's sort of like when I said yes and something nice happened.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think first a general position I've always had is that is when I put myself in a position of being deliberately uncomfortable periodically because I find that I need to kind of shake up who I think I am and what matters to me. And try a new challenge. And so that being kind of a guiding light is that there were probably a couple that come to mind, but if I go back a ways, because maybe it's a little more interesting, is that when I was 34, I went to a think tank for a year on psychology and law, and fast forward, is that I was invited to give a talk to the Oregon Bar Association. In those days, there were almost no women at the bar. Now, of course, it's, you know, over half are women. But I ended up, and I was scared to death. Everything inside me thought, I'm just going to make a colossal fool out of myself because they're all male, and they think social science is a lot of crap, basically. Yeah. You know, it didn't have a legitimacy, you know, at least certainly not in that day. But I decided to do it, and even though I was a nervous wreck, is that it went well, and I did my own obstinate thing. I gave half the talk on what they wanted to know, which is how to win, namely how to persuade. And the second half was on appellate issues, namely how do we get the quality of the decision so that the jury makes the right decision. It actually went very well. It was one of the real highs that stays kind of as a warm memory many, many years later. But I remember as I was looking at that audience, there was 1,100 people in the audience, and there were no more than 40 women at the time, is that it panicked me. But I'll tell you, ever since, those big crowds are coming in categories that are not in the majority, certainly, you know, or that might be suspect from the beginning, was an important lesson in general, because I came away not only invigorated and kind of pleased with it, but I really had a sense of really wanting to be able to address larger audiences, to have the impact of your ideas to the extent that you can defend them and they're good, not just buried in journals, but to try to do them more broadly. And that's, in some ways, this book is really my first attempt at a trade book, you know, as one for a general audience rather than buried in academic journals, because the academic journals, people can find them. But it's unsatisfying, I think, when you really would like for people not just to kind of intellectually think about the ideas, but to really implement them. so that, you know, you go back to that Pollyanna notion in a way that you'd like the workforce to be better respected, to have their ideas really utilized. I mean, all the positive things that you want for people, you know, at least my hope is that when you allow them to speak up, when you give them that kind of a respect, when you actually utilize their talents, and when you kind of get away from all of the competitive, you know, power-driven, gossip-driven kinds of meanness of it, you know, you sort of think a little way, maybe the world could be a little bit better, at least in some quarters. So, and I know how Pollyanna that sounds, but I'm kind of unapologetic at this age about sounding Pollyanna anymore. You know, kind of in the youth you do it, and then we kind of sort of lose and feel it's inappropriate. But it still is a driving force, I think, for many of us, you know.
Yep, I love it. Charlene Nemeth, thank you for coming on the show.
It was my pleasure. Also, I'm a fan of Colbert's, by the way, which I know you had a hand in.
Yeah, I did work with him. Thanks so much.
Okay, my pleasure. Thank you.